Say Big & Menards and keep cool in the summer heat with a new window air conditioner from Denali Air. Quickly and efficiently cool your spaces with auto and eco modes to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Featuring 3 fan cooling speeds and a remote control, allowing you to cool your space from anywhere in the room. Save big money on Denali Air. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in 3 delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals, and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Find it now at TraceMinerals.com. You eat well, you work out, but did you know 99% of Americans are still mineral deficient? That's where Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder comes in. It's your daily foundation for better mood, natural energy, immune support, and nervous system balance. Formulated from nature and backed by science, it's a simple habit that makes a big impact. Because your body doesn't make minerals, and today's food and water don't supply enough, with Concentrace, you'll feel the difference. Go to TraceMinerals.com and start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in 3 delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Find it now at TraceMinerals.com.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
A lot of new things coming down in the Brian Koberger case. A lot. What was thought to be maybe the last hearing before the trial starts is probably the first of many more hearings before the trial starts. Joining me to discuss, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. We've been talking about this case now for almost 3 years.
Yeah.
Now, which is kind of hard to
believe. How we met.
I know. It's crazy, but we're coming up on the 3-year mark of this in November. And you consider we're, you know, almost into June. That ain't that far off. One thing that has been very difficult for the defense of Brian Koberger to get out there is any sort of alibi. They had a deadline last summer. What's your alibi going to be? We waited. They said they were going to have one. And then, poof, here's the alibi. He likes to look at the stars.
No.
On a night that had no stars, because
no,
it was
never done, and I've never done it before either.
No, and has no history of going out and looking at the stars. Right. It was that night. That was the night that he was out going to do it. So the judge basically said, "Yeah, that's not an alibi. That's a nice little, you know, Hallmark story. Card or something, nice, like let's look at the stars together while the kids are murdered in the house." But that's not reality. Well, surprise, surprise. They are throwing another thing at the wall, and this time alternate suspect theory, alternate perpetrator is what has been brought up. They're saying a third party suspect is responsible for the murders of the 4 college students in Moscow, Idaho. Now, who is this third party? Well, they didn't bring that to the table. They're just, it's that guy. They have until, I believe, late May. There's a specific date on this. I don't have it directly in front of me to bring to the judge what this theory is. And it's under seal at this moment in time. So the judge will then decide, is this a valid enough theory that they can argue this in court? You know? You don't know. You'd be surprised sometimes what gets allowed as a third-party culprit, right, in court. And in some places, it's like, that's insane. And in some places, that's insane. And it's allowed. So we'll see what happens. This judge doesn't seem to be one that really minces words or puts up with, right, BS. Robin, what's your thoughts on this, trying to introduce this this late in the game?
It's again, she's doing all she can to earn her money for reasonable doubt to save his life. But it's interesting, you know, as you're saying this, you know, trying to go with this alternate, you know, suspect or perpetrator theory of this. Here's what I think they're hoping, you know, from, remember, there's a glove that had blood in it that was at, that is at the house, and they had other people's blood on the banister.
Yeah.
DNA, right?
DNA, so not even blood, DNA. Yeah.
DNA, right. So here's what I think they're hoping, that they can do a match to that DNA they found, that someone's buried inside of at a graveyard somewhere, that actually was a serial killer that was unfound before, and they can blame it on him. I really think they're trying to identify the DNA of this unsub and pin it on someone else that's gone, because otherwise, what do you got? I don't want to laugh about it, yeah. Make it flippant, but I mean, but they are going for so many straws on this. It's just like, at what point do you just say we're done?
Well, it makes you wonder, okay, we're going to go for an alternate suspect. How? Like, who are you picking for this? And the only thing I can think of is that they did, if they have the DNA of what they found in that glove or on the banister or under her fingernails, because there was unmarked or unknown, but Koberger's right. Wasn't excluded from being there. My guess maybe is that it's from the glove or the banister, and they themselves on the defense did a DNA, you know, reverse yep. lookup or something, or IgG or whatever it may be. And whoever lucky person that is going to be brought into this, at least in the pretrial motions. And it's going to be, how can we pin this over here? It just right. how can we make these blocks work together? And if it doesn't work, the judge is going to say bye-bye.
So what I'm thinking that they're probably going to try to do, boy, again, just pure
conjecture, yeah.
Is, you know, from again, based on Howard Bloom's great work, I'm thinking, you know, because remember, they're kind of throwing out there as a possibility that this the drug dealer kind of angle on mm-hmm. things. So if they can get that DNA and match it to a potential drug dealer or something, yeah. that's a decent reasonable doubt they might be trying to throw out there as a potential murderer instead of Koberger.
Yeah, I mean, if you get somebody that has a little shadiness to them,
maybe a conviction, maybe, you know, a rap sheet somewhere, because, you know, remember, Koberger doesn't have that.
Yeah.
Kind of. He's got a rap sheet of well, not a rap sheet. He's got, you know, a history of drug abuse and things like that. But if they can get it pinned on someone, or at least thought about someone that actually has a worse rap sheet than Koberger's background or shady background, that might work.
But do you think they're going to find somebody that's more warm, kind, inviting, and just an all-around good spirit that's going to be something that's not quite as warm as Brian Koberger because he exudes all of those traits. Not at all. That's the other part of this. You get somebody else in there. Koberger is about as cold as it gets when it comes to suspects in something like this. There's not a lot of emotion.
So Tony, I'm sorry, we're going to reference the other show that we're just talking about, talking about the Karen Reed case.
Yeah.
You gave a great example of what happened to you when you were in fourth grade, it was?
Yeah,
on the playground. Yep. Girl falls down, you ran away, mm-hmm. Because that's what kids do when we see bad things happen, and you live with that guilt for so long that you bumped into her later on when you were 19 years old, and you apologized.
Yes.
So, because that's what people with empathy that aren't psychopaths do. And so now imagine Koberger, from what we know from the data points we have using our thinking cap and our thought process, you know, can you imagine him doing that on the playground and then later on when he's 19 apologizing to someone for hurting them on the playground or even just witnessing?
I think it'd be one of those "she had that coming" processes.
Can I watch it again to see if I get some emotional rise from
it? Yeah, that's the weird part. That, yes. Yeah. And that's what separates folks like that from folks like us.
Yes. And that's like, why it's also very hard to remember. Yeah. We talk about the challenge of this in dealing with Koberger and people like Koberger when trying to do behavioral assessments, because when you're, again, we're not clinicians, we're mm-hmm. just average Joes with experience. You know, looking at someone that's edging up on psychopathy, they just don't respond and interact with the world in the same way as everyone else.
Yeah, I agree. And the interesting part of the Koberger case is his own words are what sink him even more. I mean, similar to the Karen Reed case in many ways. And it's hard because people will go, well, he was a teenager. This was several years before. Yeah, I mean, those writings were about roughly, 10-ish years before this took place. But he was recognizing something, a change in his mind, a change in his thinking, a change in his behavior, a change in empathy, where he seemed to have recognized that he had it at a younger age, and then it was just gone. And he didn't know why. He was very troubled by it. He couldn't figure out what it was, but he couldn't seem to ever get it back either. And clearly that writing, was many years before these crimes took place, but it's something he clearly struggled with in his relationships, his social circle or lack thereof. Everybody kind of has the same opinion of Ryan Koberger of just being really awkward, cold, disconnected in many ways. And then you start looking at his behavior and, what he's allegedly done, whether it be setting up that security camera in his neighbor's house that he was also a teaching assistant with, and then having access to the Wi-Fi and the password and everything, to his interactions with his students, and then the sudden change in behavior after the murders took place in the school setting. All of those speak very, very loudly to what his mindset is. And if you look at it and go, okay, well, what would the profile of someone like this have to be? I mean, someone who, is getting some sort of a rise out of this, but clearly doesn't have empathy, if they're able to do this and just move on. And that kind of fits the mold of Koberger a bit, at least as we know it right now.
Yeah, it definitely does. And this is going to be a really good case study, one way or the other, for people for years to come on the arcs of people like this. And, again, the saddest part of this whole thing is the tragic loss of the life on both sides. I feel such, compassion for everyone involved in this, because it's just such a lot of effort to try to save him. Mm-hmm. And because no one could, or others weren't able to be saved either.
Yeah. And that's the really sad part about all of this is I believe, his dad cared. I believe his mom cared. I don't know all the dynamics, but the fact is dad's, willing to go out there and talk to the neighbor even and go like, hey, my son's kind of awkward and, he could use a friend. However he phrased it, he had his son's best interests at heart. Yeah. He was thinking about his son, and he recognized that, he's kind of an odd duck. But he still loved his son, and he wanted to do, the best he could for him. But at some point, there's only so much you can do. And if someone has that broken of a brain, for whatever reason that is, they're going to go down their own path. You can't.
I know. And then you ask yourself, what could have been done?
I don't know.
I don't know either, because when you look at it, no one, from the optic we have, we weren't in the family, but from the optic we have through all the writings and Howard Bloom's work and everything else, no one ever gave up on him.
Yeah.
And so, which makes it really, really tragic, because in every other case or many other cases we look at, you're like, oh, if only this had been done, or someone recognized the signs, or they interjected themselves. But that was done all the time with him. I mean, people were very compelled to try to do something, and did do things. Mm-hmm. And we're still left with four dead babies.
Yeah,
and I mean, babies as, because they're someone's babies. I always talk about our kids as our babies.
Yeah, they always will be. Yeah, no matter what. The Howard Bloom had done some very interesting work. He's done a lot of interesting reporting on this case. He's written the book, and he's also continued to write about it in many articles. Airmail, he's had some very interesting ones. As of late, and we've talked about that on the show a bit. And he was speaking about Dr. Catherine Ramsland, who we've had on the show as well. Very respected criminal psychologist. She's one of the best in the world at this, and the utmost respect there. His theory was that maybe Koberger was doing this in a weird, sick way to try and impress her. To be the bigger person in the room, even than her, because that seems to be what Koberger liked to do on what he perceived as kind of a psychological level. He also had said stuff in there about that Catherine had some sort of contact with the family. Catherine has responded to that, actually, directly to us.
Oh, wow.
And let me read her writing here. In fact, I got to turn around because I can't see it very well. On that screen over there. I heard your podcast. I have recently made a statement in response to Bloom's allegations because it's not about Koberger. It's about me. I had no email correspondence with Brian Koberger while he was at WSU. He has not been in touch with me since his arrest. I called his parents as a gesture of kindness, but I do not advise them about the case. I did not call them hours after the arrest, as Bloom claims. I have never talked to his sister about any book. I did not broker anything regarding a lawyer. I have not been invited by the Kobergers to Idaho. I don't know where they'll be staying. I don't know who Bloom's source is or why he reports information for which he has no proof. So I let her know, hey, you know, I'm going to put this out there a lot in the future about this, to hear her side of this against Bloom's allegations that were made. He has since apologized as well, and at least kind of clarified on his own Twitter about it, and saying, okay, well, this is a theory, so mm-hmm. to speak. And okay, take all the parts out of that where he was, or she was, he was talking about her having communication. He's said, okay, you know, I believe you. That was, you know, my wrong, whatever.
I like this though. I mean, that's really consistent with what you'd expect from someone of her position, of her background, of her relationship with him. That looks very, again, we're always looking for congruency and anything that spikes out, that looked really congruent. But I still like Howard's theory that he did this for her, but not in that way in which I think he initially intended it, or at least we consumed it. I still kind of go with the undercurrent of, you know, remember, people that are high on narcissism, psychopathy, it's all about grandiosity. Mm-hmm. And the idea that he had a connection with her or liked her focus, liked what she did, was impressed by her, the grandiosity by her accolades. Like you said, she's world renowned. So what better grandiosity than to be the study of his favorite professor and someone of this notoriety. So I really liked, I think, again, it's never just one thing, but I think that makes reasonable sense to me that someone of, again, if it's him or someone like him, would be going for that kind of notoriety from someone like her, not because she's going to say, oh my God, this is the best ever. No, because she's going to study him.
Yeah.
Because remember, part of what he's trying to do is trying to figure out who he is and why he is like he is. What better person to try to figure out that than her?
Yeah.
And so if he can do something to get her attention as a case study, will that not help him to understand who he is a bit better?
He would be infamous. He would live in infamy.
Infamous with the greatest of grandiosity. And he could continue to contribute by killing even more.
He could, and he could eventually end up teaching about himself.
Yes.
Without anybody knowing it. It seems like, I mean, on the surface, a bit of a stretch, but if you've been looking at this case as closely as we have been for 3 years, it makes sense. And at the beginning, one of the things I said, and I it didn't make a lot of sense, but I kind of felt it, was why did he do this? You know, was it because, you know, he was jealous of the lifestyle of these kids, that he couldn't get the girls? Like, could that be contributing factors? You know, I could see some of that in there. Certainly, I think that's part of it. But I do think what I've always felt on this is he did it because he wanted the experience, because he values education. He values expertise in this area and the rush,
the response.
But at the end of the day, it's not necessarily he gets, I think, more of a rush of being that character, because he got rushes, I think, from looking at these characters, like the Bundys and all of this.
Yeah.
And if he could become that character, maybe if he becomes that character, the people he looks up to and he's better than, then he can feel good about himself.
Yes, that's what I think the pursuit here is with most of these people. And whenever anyone comes out, so you got Howard Bloom and other people that have done deep dives on this. When anyone that does that kind of deep dive research says something, I always pay attention because there's something there.
Yeah.
And so in my mind, it's like, how do we take that little glimmer he's got of something here and actually kind of try to make it fit. And that's how I think we do this here, because I don't think it should be dismissed. I just don't think it was the original potential way that we took it. Is like, oh, he's trying to impress her. Nah, I think he's trying to get her. I think he was using her as a tool, like all psychopaths do. She was going to be a tool to allow him to be better,
mm-hmm.
to be what he wants to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it was like sexually motivated or anything like that towards Catherine. I do right. think there was certainly a sexual motivation towards the girls, or one of the girls at least,
I'd say that, because that's what psychopaths do.
Yeah. So I think
serial killers.
Plus he had a penchant. I mean, from the Dateline reporting and the pictures that we saw that they reported on, there was a certain characteristic of all of those women that he put on his phone. It seemed to be consistent in all of them. Mm-hmm. And also consistent, in the victims, as well. One could say, well, he's a guy. I'm like, yeah, to a certain extent, but you know, I don't know a lot of guys that are doing this the way he was. You know, it was right. a very backwards ass way of, I mean, he's like taking pictures from other people's Facebook pages and right. stuff and putting them on his phone. And like, there's plenty of places if you want to find pretty looking ladies without like creepily stalking-ish people that you are surrounded by in real life. That seems creepy. But again, it speaks to a lot of elements that will probably never make it into the court conversation, but it does make sense when you look at the character and the grandiosity. Another piece of this that we've talked about many times, but again, with this context, makes it make a little more sense. That would be the Papa Rogers online persona, which really seems to be a nod to Elliot Rogers, the incel that killed all those people.
Right.
And then the fact that his profile picture looks exactly like Brian Koberger before anybody knew who Brian Koberger was. And the Papa Rogers profile also tweeted out things that had absolutely no public knowledge about the knife sheath, about some of the possible thought processes that were going on at the time. So he was really into the cat and mouse game. I think he was going to try and play that for longer. But I think the walls started closing in, and that's why he's
and part of this too is experimentation to see what works for him, you know, and so see where he's getting the rush. If this doesn't work, we'll try something else, because serial killers evolve, you know, into, you know, who they become. To get what they, you know, for the fantasy they need to have. And so part of that process is, you know, dabbling in different areas to see if this works, And I think he was on his most recent iteration was what he did. Again, if guilty.
He's so stoic in court. You know, you get no emotion out of him whatsoever, no matter what is being talked about. I mean, that just may be, you know, his attorney said, don't show emotion. I don't know the answer to that, but maybe she did. And maybe he's very good at following the rules and those sort of rules, very, you know, like academic type rules. And that's just what he's doing. But I mean, what is that say to you about any of this? I mean, does it say anything at all that he's being so stoic? Is he sitting there? Is he rationalizing this behavior? Is he thinking that, you know, well, they had it coming, he's in the right? I mean, let's assume he did it. What the hell do you think is going on in his mind in court?
I literally just think he's taking in data. I mean, that's all he's doing. I don't think he's having an emotional response of, I didn't do it, I did do it. You know, they're wrong. You know, they had it coming. I don't think any of that's going through his head. I think what's going through his head is, you know, work the problem. You know, he's a problem worker.
Yeah.
And his problem that he was working was him and his need for this rush. And this is a solution he came up with. I mean, so I just think he's working that problem by taking in more data, by taking in the environment, taking in what's going on. And as for lack of emotion, whether he's getting direction or not, I mean, is there really an emotion he could exhibit that you think would be appropriate?
I don't know the answer to that, because you don't want to show guilt. You don't want to show like, but I guess, but what, I mean, would, if you want to be found, like? I don't know. But I think if there is one appropriate emotion, if you want to be found innocent in this, would be horror, would be empathy, would be
incapable.
Like, oh my God, you know, and just
he's incapable.
Yes, you're exactly right. Koberger is kind of like AI. He's like the human yes. version of AI, where it's if AI were to be transplanted into a human being, Brian Koberger would be it. The empathy element isn't there. Although I think AI can pretend to know empathy better than he can.
I think my AI talks better than he does.
Yes, yes. But it really isn't. It's just very data-driven. And right. sometimes the data in AI, it produces something where it thinks it's just 1,000% on, and it'll give you a bunch of reasons why, and you go, wait a second, look at this. It's like, right. ooh, I apologize for that. And it just completely misses it. And right. I think someone with Koberger's line of thinking is a lot like that, can bring up far more points than the average human being could into how you can be successful at this task. But at the same point, there's going to be some sort of hiccup in there. There's going to be some sort of delusion or illusion in there that doesn't make sense to the rest of it, but somehow in his mind just came up because the empathy doesn't exist. And then that gets slipped in and it throws the whole thing to hell, which is, I think, what it pretty much happened here.
Agreed.
It's a creepy story. There's a lot to come. The judge also not very happy with Dateline on this. They're doing their reporting. They got a source. I mean, just like, government officials have sources, reporters have sources, everybody's got sources. That's how we end up finding out information. But he's not happy. He is diving deep into this, putting an order in that everybody needs to preserve anything on their phones as of right now who had anything to do with this case, because he wants to find that leak, because what came out in Dateline was not supposed to be coming out before court. So some big pieces there. Makes you wonder what other big pieces are going to come out.
From the very beginning, he's doing all he can to mitigate any potential appeals, which we know are going to happen.
Yeah.
So he's doing the best he can on that, and that plays into it.
Certainly does. There's certainly a lot more to come, and the trial is literally, we're almost to June. What do we got here? Wow, we're like 2 months away.
Finally.
This is going to be fascinating.
Craving non-stop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.